come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
We're excited today to announce that our guest is Pulitzer Prize winning author Junot Diaz, who we'll be speaking with right about his big collection of work.
You know, he actually only has three books, but these three books are amazing, and one of them won the Pulitzer Prize. Right. How many people can say that?
I mean, you know, his first book, Drown, a collection of stories, was on the best-selling books list for a long time. You know, it's
right.
for a first collection.
And he was in the New Yorker so right. many times that people thought maybe, you know, they started calling it the Junot Diaz Yorker.
Oh, yeah, right.
No, they didn't really do that, but it's a great conversation.
The Junot Yorker.
It's a great conversation. So stick around. He's a very nice, gracious guy. You know, I remember when I was in when I first started teaching here, Drown was out. There was a long time between Drown and his
right.
next book.
About 11 years or so.
When yeah. Drown came out, I remember a lot of the male Latino students in my class, they loved it.
Right.
And almost every week I would get another wannabe Junot Diaz story.
Right, right.
Some of them were good. Some of
no,
them were not
sure.
so good. But he really, that kind of voice of Junior.
It was really influential, yeah. I think, you know, to a lot of writers, myself included in that. You know, I would have been one of the students sending you my Junot Diaz story also.
Right.
You know, not that his place that he was writing about, New York or the Dominican Republic, not that I could identify with that, but certainly the stories, the characters, the sort of situations he was talking about, the sort of the language in the dialogue
right.
of these characters, I could relate. And, you know, I'm growing up over there on the West Coast, you know, completely opposite side of the spectrum. But being able to, you know, read this book and resonate with these characters, to me, it was like nothing I had ever read up until that point, you know. And even with all the great Chicano, Latino writers out that right. have been out in the world, I think Junot, for me, was just a fresh voice that I had been waiting for at the right time. It came along. You know?
That makes sense. And the word voice is very significant in this
right.
because I'm thinking about, you know, I've been teaching creative writing workshops for many years now, over 10 years. Oh, my God, has it been 14, 15 years? Wow. I thought I was only 20 years old.
Yeah.
But when a student, mostly male students, because female students have their different influences, but when male students read William Faulkner, right. they turn in stories that are voice-driven in a kind of pseudo-Faulknerian sort
right.
of way. I mean, it's just part
sure.
of the learning,
is,
the learning
right.
process.
Right.
I remember when I first read Sound and Fury, the next five stories I turned into workshop were Furious. Really horrible
we're
imitations of Faulkner. But Junot sure. Diaz has such a... an effect on the literary culture
right.
That I think his voice, and his voice is so strong and so unique that I think that's why the students, when they read Faulkner or they read Junot Diaz, they got to get that voice out of their heads.
Right.
So they got to have to write some stories
that's right.
with
I
those
think
voices.
That's probably the best way of putting it, as we have to kind of exercise those,
right.
You know, those ideas that we have that reading Faulkner or reading Junot's work, you know, puts into our minds, and we have to get them out of us before we can
yeah,
move
and
on
it,
to our
and
own
it's
work.
Okay.
It
it's
is.
Okay.
You know,
it's part of the
emulating.
Process.
I think so a lot of us, we start in sort of emulating, and then later on we start to develop our voice that way
right.
and know where, you know, our strengths and our weaknesses. So,
yeah. In language itself, the development of language itself
right.
is about emulation, and it reminds me of when I was in grad school. This was actually as an undergrad. I had Steve Yarbrough,
oh, right. yeah.
who was a novelist, Southern novelist. Now he's teaching at Boston University, but I turned in a story that was clearly influenced by Faulkner, and he says to me in workshop, it's about all he said. He says, "Danny, just let Faulkner be Faulkner."
And Chacon be Chacon.
And that was it. No more discussion. And, you know, and I understand his sentiment, but I also think that when we teach creative writing, we have to allow these students to be influenced
sure.
by voices like Junot Diaz.
Sure, yeah.
And I'm very excited he's on the show.
Yeah, so we're going to have Junot Diaz here on Words on a Wire. Stick around. Junot Diaz was born in the Dominican Republic and raised in New Jersey. He's the author of the critically acclaimed Drown, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, which won the 2008 Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award, and his most recent collection, This Is How You Lose Her, which is a New York Times bestseller. He's the recipient of the MacArthur Genius Fellowship and Guggenheim Fellowship and many other awards, too many to actually name, and he's a graduate of Rutgers College. He's currently the fiction editor at Boston Review, and he teaches at MIT. Junot Diaz, welcome to Words on a Wire.
No, thank you guys so much for having me.
You are, well, the second Latino to win the Pulitzer Prize in fiction. First one was Oscar Ijuelos, of course, I think in 1990. When we heard that news that you won, we were incredibly excited. And by we, I mean Latino writers.
Right, yeah, of course.
It was a big deal for us. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about when you found out and what it means to you and anything you can tell us about that
experience.
When you learned about winning the Pulitzer.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad. There's not much to say. I was at my mother's house. She was packing up to go to the Dominican Republic, you know, it's her annual visit. And she wanted me to keep an eye on my nephew while she was packing. And so I was hanging out with my nephew. I guess he must have been around five then. I was younger, actually. No, about four. And, you know, me and him were messing around. And then my phone just started blowing up. My friends were like, yo, turn on the news. And that was the extent of it. And just to show you something about how cultural capital does not translate. When I told my mother that, oh, yeah, listen, I just won a Pulitzer Prize, she's like, how much is it? I was like, well, let me look.
Right.
And I was like, oh, it's $10,000. And she was just like, yo, that sounds really weak. So she was not impressed.
That's fantastic.
Right.
My dad, who was a Chicano working class all his life, when I came out with the book, I did a reading in my hometown, and then a couple of months later, I did another reading. He goes, "Is this another book?" And I go, "No, it's the same one." He goes, "When are you going to write another one?"
Yeah. Juno, since your first book, Drown, which came out in 1996, to The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde in 2008, to This Is How You Loser, which was in 2012. That's a span of 16 years there, and we get to see Junior, your main character, come into his own across those three books. So tell us a little bit about why Junior gets to have this continued presence in your books.
Well, I mean, he's been an incredibly generative alter ego for me. I began the project in Drown, but with the plan to follow Junior over a number of books. There was a sense that once I sort of constructed his character, I realized that this is somebody who would be really, really good to just follow. There was a lot of things about his character that I just really struck me that I could sort of keep returning to. It just seemed like a deep enough well. And so I kind of sketched out a three or four book project, the way you do when you're like an overconfident, still got hair on your head. Young person. And then I kind of tried to see if I could, cash the check that I had signed. And that's what's been happening over the last few years.
So between Drown and Oscar Wilde, there was a span of 11 years. And as a fan, I'm wondering, what took you so long? Were you working on the book the whole time? Were you holding out on us? What was going on in those 11 years?
We're going down that path. Right? So you had four car accidents in the last 5 years. How do you feel? Come on, man. Nah, man. I'm just a slow writer. And I'll be honest, man. I'm not the kind of writer that anyone should ever want to emulate. I'm very phobic around writing. I'm myself not, I haven't drank the Kool-Aid. I'm a very different persona than the average writer. Now, we all like to think of ourselves as exceptional, but the truth of it is that almost all the writers I know are really gung-ho about writing. They think fiction is an unalloyed good. They think themselves practicing fiction is an even higher good.
Right.
And I'm not entirely, from my own point of view, I'm not entirely convinced there is room in our artistic practices for practitioners who are very ambivalent about their own practice. I am not convinced that fiction is just a completely unalloyed good. I'm troubled by a lot of what is required from an individual to write fiction and what's the kind of ideological work that fiction plays. And that might seem to a lot of people like a lot of highfalutin nonsense, but look, man, there's been a ton of history of artists who are troubled by their practice.
Right.
And I think that my production is not helped by the fact that I'm one of those people who didn't drink the Kool-Aid. I'm not sure that this is just because I like doing it and just because I have some talent doing it. I'm not sure that it's always wonderful and always good. Right. I mean, if this was the case, fiction writers would have solved every problem in the world.
Right.
The writing, you know, there would be no racism in literature because this is such an overwhelming, unalloyed, unquestionable good. We should have undone classism. We should have undone sexism.
Sure.
We should have undone a whole bunch of things. But in fact, fiction, like most arts, plays an incredibly important role in stabilizing and reproducing hegemonic oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And again, for some people, they don't want to think about it. And I'm like, cool. You've got the entire history of artists telling you, yes, what you do is wonderful and good, and go be do you.
Right.
But there's got to be room for people like me that, you know, that we're saying, hey, man, this is something I can do. This is something that I do pretty okay at, but I'm not entirely sure. I'm not, for me, I'm just not sure. And that doesn't help production, you know, wrestling with myself. I think it helps the art. I think it certainly helps the art. It doesn't help you produce the art.
I was reading this interview where you had said there are two types of writers, those who write for other writers and those who write for readers, and that you had preferred keeping readers in mind. And, you know, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about, you know, writing for readers.
Well, I mean, look, the nature of the way that the creative writing industry works, and, you know, look, I'm a product of the creative writing industry. I don't think of this as an enemy, but I do think that one needs to be critical of any enterprise. If you care about something, being critical is a way that you make a thing better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But again, it's the idea of being critical, not about the just bashing it. And for me, when I think about one of the distortions that creative writing inflicts on a lot of folks is that their sort of worldview around their work is filtered through other writers reading their work and not filtered through disinterested readers.
Right.
My students who are in workshop, they're not actually getting opinions from a disinterested reader.
Right. Yeah.
They're getting opinions from, as we say in Spanish, gente que tiene interés.
Sí.
Right.
You know, and I think it's very different. Like, I'm sorry, if I'm a mechanic and come up with an interesting way of fixing a car and I present it to other mechanics, you get a very different reaction versus you present it to 10 car owners.
Right, right, yep.
It kind of reminds me of that old idea. I think we used to attribute it to John Updike that, you know, he writes for an ideal reader, and that ideal reader is a 19-year-old male and undergraduate at an East Coast college or something like that, which is almost another way to express that, you know, you're writing for somebody that isn't disinterested, but somebody that's already particular vision or archetype. Whereas I like what Borges says. He says that he writes the kind of fiction he wants to read, really kind of goes back to the reader.
Sure. But, you know, those are kind of individual manifestos. I'm sort of talking about at a deeper level. What are the structures of artistic production?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, how is one inculcated? How does one's writerly imagination begin to form? And I think that there's very few people who would argue that there's been a huge shift in creative writing, and that creative writing has become deeply professionalized, and most creative writers spend most of their time around other writers and not around readers.
Right, right. Yep, I agree. Yeah.
I mean, gee whiz, I know creative writing people because they just want to spend time with other writers.
Right.
And I, you know, and again, not all. You know, I'm just using these kind of, I'm just, you know, using this stuff to structure the argument. I don't really believe all creative writers are like this. It's just a way of you talking. But certainly there's enough folks who are thinking this way that, you know, you can throw an AWP and thousands of folks will show up. And, you know, you follow any of those folks. They spend a lot of time around other writers and very little time around other readers, people who just are just readers.
Right.
And I think that that's had an impact. I think that that's had an impact. And it certainly is not where I'm from. I try to avoid possible because they're not my audience.
Right.
I mean, I'm glad other writers would read me if they're interested. But I'm definitely not interested in, that's not who I have in mind. I don't have a creative writing workshop standing over my work with a big sharp pen. That's not the way it works, man. That's not for me. And again, I'm not saying this is everyone,
right,
but
sure.
It definitely isn't for me.
Well, it would make sense, because if you're in a creative writing workshop and you begin to, whether consciously or not, write for the workshop, and if you're in a MFA program that isn't very diverse, that a person of color, a writer of color, can not only begin to write for the workshop, but to be able to write for the mainstream and kind of feel like they need to somehow be a missionary for their culture. And that certainly might affect their work in negative ways.
Well, I mean, or it just affect their work. If we just leave, it just affect their work, period.
Okay, right.
And I think that is like, just imagine you played baseball. I mean, for me, it's like always comes back to baseball in a way. But imagine you play baseball, and the only people who are allowed in the stadium are middle-class men. Mm-hmm. That alters everything about the game. You might say that doesn't, but it certainly alters the language. It alters what people,
right.
You know, it just, the expectations are very different. You know,
right,
you're not gonna build any, you don't need to build any bathrooms for women. And I think that this is a way of thinking about just what happens in a very quiet, passive, almost molecular way when the structures lead one, whether they wish to or not, to just practice imagining that they're, you know, who their native community is other writers, instead of imagining their native communities as readers.
Right.
And I think that has been a huge way of guiding my life as an artist. Again, when I close my eyes and I think about who my tribe is, I think of a dozen other readers. I do not think of a dozen other writers.
A lot of Latino writers and a lot of Latino readers kind of attribute to you the decision not to italicize the Spanish. You know, even though there might have been others who have done it before you, or, you know, concurrently with you or after you, even, you know, if they didn't get it from you, you are kind of credited for that. And so was that a particular political, or was it a formal choice to not do that?
Well, I mean, every formal choice has a political choice.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like if you make a formal choice that's status quo, that's a political choice.
Right.
I guess, you know, for me personally, it was certainly being an immigrant. The question for me was always, well, okay, so we italicized quote unquote foreign words. That would mean I would have to italicize both English and Spanish. So the whole thing's either italicized or
right.
None of it's italicized.
Who was it that we had on the show? And he was saying, the guy who spoke at Obama's, the poet.
Richard Blanco.
Right.
Ricardo, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, you know, very similar to that, he says that he doesn't have a second language, that his first language is Spanish and English.
See, I'm the exact opposite. I don't have a first. My second language is Spanish and English.
That's good.
So, Juno, in your introduction for the VONA anthology, and VONA's the Voices of Our Nation Arts Foundation and Workshops, but in the anthology Dismantle, you wrote about the lack of diversity in MFA writing programs back when you were in school, and even still today. Not only the lack of diversity, but also the unwillingness to, you know, talk about race in the writing workshops. So tell us a little bit about why VONA was necessary, because I know that you were one of the co-founders of that. So why did you feel VONA was something that was just critical to get started?
Well, look, we live in a country where people believe more in extraterrestrials than in white supremacy. You know, they're like, I believe that there's aliens and spaceships more than I believe that there's structural racism. I mean, that's pretty much true.
Right.
And when you're dealing with, look, when you're dealing with an atmosphere where the quote-unquote hegemonic minority is not only resistant, but hostile to anyone examining the structures of their privilege and the way that they oppress, then you're in a weird situation, because as an artist who wants to write in a way that pursues this critical vision of the world, you want to be in a space where your reality is not just barely tolerated, but that your reality, you know, is central.
Sure.
And if you're a writer of color, you know, being in a safe space in an environment where claims such as there's no longer any racism, claims such as, well, the only reason that you're being published is because you're a minority, claims such as, it's really a great market to be, quote unquote, a minority writer. When those claims are general, I don't think those are really safe spaces. And I think many writers of color feel that it would be a nice experience to be able to learn in a space where not only they were safe, but where their considerations, whether they wish to tackle them or address them or not, are considered normative.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, fellas, it's tough because I came up at a time where, and a lot of my young people who talk to me have similar experiences where, you know, you come up in these institutions that are mainstream institutions, and they're not always really generous and really nice to writers of color, especially writers of color who are a bit challenging, who are kind of saying, you know, this kind of status quo stuff is screwed up and I want to write about that. Those
right.
students don't often have an easy time. And VONA and the Asian American Writers Workshop and Kavik Khanum and the Zora Neale Hurston Richard Wright Foundations, I think that these are really important, important spaces for producing the kinds of artists that, again, are going to be the future.
Right. And do you think that those spaces should exist outside, completely outside of those academic, the academic world, or can they help shape what MFA programs look like?
Well, I mean, my whole thing is that it is not one of those cruel buffets where you're only allowed to choose one entree. You know, it's not like you only get the chicken or the beef food.
Right.
Like, you know, if yo quiero habichuela, yo quiero carne, también vegetales. Uh-huh. And my thing is that this is all about multiple strategies.
Right.
I'm not arguing that this is somehow the only strategy. I'm arguing that this is just a strategy that I'm interested in. But I'm also teaching in a mainstream university, very elite select college university.
Right.
And I, you know, I bring my A game to my incredibly diverse students and try to do that work inside of an institution. You know, I represent the belief that multiple strategies is useful for those of us who can't tell the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You never know. Yeah. You never know what's going to work, man.
Right.
Are there any particular MFA programs that you can think of off the top of your head that might be more suited towards encouraging writers of color?
Well, I mean, what do I know? I'm not in them. I think the thing is, I'm not just making a joke. I think that the matter is that programs are very fluid. Faculty come in, faculty come out.
Right.
You could get a dean one day that's really positive about the program, the dean the next day that's hostile towards the program. I think it's important, alas, that whoever is interested in the program, she has to actually do her research.
Right.
You know,
right,
because you got to find out if you're feeling safe. You know, you got to find out if the students there are happy. And I still remember, we're talking about in the early 90s, I still remember asking them straight up. I was like, before I came there, I was like, are there people of color? And Cornell was like, your entire group, the five of you are coming, are all people of color. I'm like, bet, dope. Are there any faculty of color? They're like, in fiction, no. And we decided when we got there that this was a problem. And, you know, we're the ones, us grad students and undergraduates at Cornell, who actually got the first person of color teacher, Elena Maria Viramontes,
right.
One of the most brilliant Chicana writers.
I remember that.
We are the ones who spearheaded getting her hired.
Oh, wow.
So our critique of these programs produced a very positive effect. Now, Cornell wanders around boasting that they have the most diverse program, but this gets kicked off by a group of students of color who criticized their lack of diversity, who pushed the school into having more diversity, and now they want to sort of claim, you know, our hard work and the kind of courage and audacity it takes for these young students, which we were, to challenge these really kind of powerful institutions. You know, they want to sort of say, well, look what we've done. And I'm like, well, give credit where it's due.
Right.
It was all the undergraduates who put their necks on the line, almost all of them young women,
wow.
The majority of them Chicana,
wow.
who made the Cornell MFA program the diverse program it is today.
Mm, right.
But, you know, you get the head of the program being like, well, there's no racism and our program is incredibly diverse. And I'm like, well, it's actually the reason your program is incredibly diverse is because there is institutional racism in the classroom. And students of color, most of them women, most of them Chicana, stood up against that and transformed your school.
We're running out of time, but I'd like to ask you one last question about, I'll start with a quote that you said something on Bill Moyers. You said that fantasy and science fiction sometimes has a better grasp on describing reality than does realistic fiction. And I'm wondering if you can kind of address that as you talk a little bit about Monstro, which is your, I guess, your next book.
Yeah, I'm not writing that book anymore. It sucks, so it died. I'm terrible, guys. Yeah, but you know, I still hold to that claim. You know, like, I mean, you know, I said this the other day talking to some young people, and it's true. It's like the genres, the reason these genres have thrived and continue to have purchase on people's imagination is because so much of who we are as people, so much of our culture, so much of what we call the social, the culture, the political, so much of that is an unspeakable. And genres are really good at approaching the unspeakable. Now, look, the average person doesn't get a really strong sense reading mainstream traditional fiction or poetry or essays about how screwed up we are around our bodies and around mortality, around the fact that we're going to die. But let me tell you, if some alien from the future gets a hold of a horror movie, and that's the artifact that survives from our culture, they're going to be like, yo, these guys had a lot of issues around their mortality and a lot of issues around their body. You wouldn't get that. I'm sorry, no offense, but you wouldn't get that reading a mainstream piece of work, not with the same force.
All right,
and I think that the way you understand the real is by approaching it from multiple angles, deploying multiple strategies and multiple modes, and some of them fantastic. In fact, I find the most useful ones to be fantastic.
We have been speaking with award-winning author Junot Diaz. Juno, thank you so much for your time and joining us here on Words on a Wire.
Yeah, gentlemen, thank you so much, man. You know, again, thank you for taking the time.
We'd like to thank our guest, Junot Diaz, for joining us for this week's Words on a Wire.
It's been a real pleasure. His books have given shape to the American literary landscape for at least the past 20 years. We anticipate whatever he has in store for us.
Yeah, right? And you know, he's just so smart. I mean, he's a brilliant guy. I mean, I just love hearing him talk. You can watch some of his videos on YouTube or anywhere on the net.
He went by so quick.
Incredibly articulate. We could have talked to him for hours.
I know.
And I'm going to end today's show with a quote.
Nice.
From Who's This Is How You Loser by Junot Diaz.
Wonderful.
And this is kind of how I felt about our interview.
Okay.
You know, we could have went on, but that's when you know it's over. As soon as you start thinking about the beginning, it's the end. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
See you next week.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope.